to introduce the people who are here on the Court with Class program. And if they'd stand, as their school is called, the Sauk Prairie High School, they made it through the snow. Thank you. West Dallas Central High School, they didn't make it through the snow. Wisconsin Heights High School, you're going to carry the whole load then if we ask questions. And now that you and those of you who are here have met I'd like to now introduce the court to you. On the end of the bench down here is Justice Patrick Crooks, and Justice John Wilcox, myself, acting Chief Justice, but receiving none of the $8,000. Justice William Matlins, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and Justice Dave Prosser. So I think we're ready then to go to the call of the first case, which is Arneson. I'm not used to this. What's the total? Oh, it's Rodney Arneson versus Marcia Jezwinski. Fine. And who is the first to argue? Won't you stand up and identify yourself, please? I think that's why she gave me this case, to pronounce the Polish name. I married an Olenichik, so I know how to handle
it. I've tried to learn over the years to pronounce them correctly. My name is Jacqueline McCauley. I represent Rod Arneson, who is a petitioner at this level, plaintiff at the trial court level. May it please the court, this case is before you solely on the narrow issue of whether defendants are entitled to qualified immunity against trial on the charge that they violated plaintiff Rod Arneson's right to pre-disciplinary due process. You must decide if the court below is correct in concluding that, and I'm quoting, because of the apparent conflict in the Wisconsin statutes on the subject of civil service tenure rights, in the inconclusive nature of cases interpreting them, Arneson has not satisfied us that on the day he was disciplined, that it was clearly established state and federal law gave him any property interest in the position he was occupying that would require a hearing or other process prior to his temporary suspension without pay and demotion. I added to that statement.
Could you lower the podium a bit? I'm having a little trouble hearing. I think there's...
Is this the microphone?
No, there's a button up there. It's magic.
Thank you
very much.
Is it better?
For me it is, yes.
Okay. I added without pay to the quotation because it's important to acknowledge that Mr. Arneson was at one point suspended with pay while the employer investigated charges against him, and later as part of punishment was given a permanent suspension for 30 days without pay. In deciding the issue of qualified immunity from trial, qualified immunity of the defendants from trial, that is, the court has two questions before it, plus the question of statutory construction raised by the court below for the first time. First question is, did Mr. Arneson have a property right in his position at the time he was disciplined? The answer in the Civil Service Code and administrative rules is yes. Those property rights are created by state law, and state law created property rights in this situation.
But he only had a property right basically in his permanent position, MS3 position, correct?
Yes.
That's what you're saying is very clear.
I pondered that question, and I think it doesn't matter whether we decide he had a permanent position. He had property rights in his promotional or original position. Either way, he was demoted below that, below his original position, and disciplined 30 days without pay, and given a severe pay cut.
Hypothetically, if he had been newly employed and had been on probation, it's clear, if we're getting into this clearly established, but if you read that statute, it said that a probationary employee is basically at will rather than having acquired some property rights. So at the time of the incident, at least, as they read this, he was on probation for the 1 year in his new position.
Yes.
Okay.
And he wasn't entitled to stay in that new position. They could have demoted him back to the old position or a comparable position, or even put him on layoff if it wasn't available.
At will. At will.
But
without a due process hearing.
Right. But they couldn't do more than that, and they did far more than that.
Well, tell me what they did. So just to clear, when you said they did far more, as I understand the facts and looking at the appendix of the state, he was at MS-3, but he ended up below that. And then he voluntarily, because he did not like the hours, as I understand, made some further voluntary changes.
Yes, it was severe. He was working nights over the weekend, so he couldn't see his family, and then daytimes after a 24-hour break, and it was severe. He simply couldn't hack that. He doesn't have a constitution to hack that, so that was part of the punishment, I assume, although it may have been the only available thing that they could assign him to. It's important to note that he was demoted below his original position before they found a position for him. So it wasn't a matter of there not being a position left to demote him to his old position. They deliberately demoted him below the old position. They didn't look to put him in the old position at all.
Well, had his old position been filled by someone else?
Yes.
So was it available? Was there a level 3 position available?
I don't think that was determined. I think it was obvious it wasn't available. Somebody had to fill it. He was the supervisor for second shift data processing. That is the important shift, and they couldn't let it go without a head.
Ask the question that Justice Crooks was relating to. In other words, it's your position that if the position is filled, his former position is filled, are you saying that they had to find a position if one did not exist?
That's right. They had to search for a comparable position or put him on layoff. The instructive case is a personnel commission case, Jensen versus University, versus UW system, and I believe Jensen was a UW-Madison employee. The personnel commission lays it out very clearly in this decision, which is cited in our cases.
In this case, just as long as you're on that subject, the personnel commission, he then appealed after several weeks. Your client appealed, and then the commission took considerable time, some 22 months as I recall, and then they rendered a decision indicating that that he was wrongfully discharged, and they restored him to his quote original position with back pay and payment of attorney fees, as I recall.
Yes.
Have I misstated that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The commission, before the personnel commission, the major question was he afforded due process? No, he was not. That's the commissioner's decision.
Yes.
The commissioner is subject to revision by the other commissioners, because the final decision is a decision of all three commissioners.
Yes.
So he had to, in case they rejected that, go on to make findings as to whether or not the discipline was appropriate. They found the discipline was not appropriate, but that's not the guiding order of the personnel commission. The guiding order of the personnel commission is he was not afforded due process, undo the discipline. In undoing the discipline, the parties never had any argument about this until it was appealed to the higher court. By undoing the discipline means he goes back to his promotional position.
His supervisory
position.
Right. And I should have said that rather than implying that it was his permanent MS-3 position.
He goes back to his supervisory MIS-4
position. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
If you read the record, there's confusion all the way along. Actually, and I never could correct it, it's a MIS supervisory position, and that's an important point.
Ms. McCauley, I'm a bit confused. Was he made whole?
No, he was not.
And in what respects was he not made whole?
He was instructed to be, the personnel commission, by undoing the discipline, said that he was to be restored to his supervisory position. That wasn't available. There was no comparable position available. He had to accept another position. We had attorney's fees, only at $75 an hour, but that's beside the point. And he received back pay with interest, but there was no way for him to regain his career. He's in a field where, if you own a computer, you know computers are outdated in 6 months. He's in a field of data processing where his job, he has to keep up with his job and keep up with new developments on a month-by-month basis. By the time he got the Personnel Commission decision, he was almost three years out of the loop where he would have kept up. Basically, it cost him his career, cost him career opportunities. The university would not retrain him. They would not give him any help in regaining his career. This is not part of the case before you, but basically all they did was threaten. Let me reiterate that what is before you is the narrow issue of whether the defendants are entitled to qualified immunity. The question of damages as to whether or not he was made whole is a matter for the trial court. I don't think we have to retry what led to the discipline, but I do think we have to retry what the discipline was, whether or not he was actually afforded due process, and it's up to this court to say what process he was due. And we have to decide what his damages were.
Counsel, if you'd assist me with the framework. We have here a couple of questions, and there's disagreement as to what the questions are, I think. As I understand it, this is all under the umbrella of qualified immunity.
Yes, that's the
point. And there's a two-step test to see if there is qualified immunity. The first step, as I understand it, is whether or not there is a property interest. There apparently is a little disagreement, and I'm going to reiterate what I understand the analysis, and tell me if I'm wrong. There apparently is a little disagreement. Your opposing counsel postures the question as to whether or not there's a clearly recognized federal property interest. You don't posit the question in that way, but both questions deal with property interest. Clearly established, federal, I don't know. Those are issues. But the first question deals with property interest. The second question deals with whether or not there is a clearly established right to pre-disciplinary due process. Do I have the analysis down in terms of the questions or
yes,
the issues?
Yes, you do, and that was what I was going on with my opening statement.
Yes.
The second step is clearly established, but the first step is there's no clearly establishedness.
I know you disagree with your opposing counsel as to whether or not the property interest has to be, number one, clearly established, or number two, federal. It's your position that it's the property interest or state. Focusing on this, then, the first question, property interest. And it was a question that was asked earlier by, I think, Justice Wilcox, whether or not there was a property interest in the permanent position or probationary position. And you kind of channeled that question and said it doesn't make any difference because he was demoted. But I want to stay with whether or not there is a property interest in a probationary status when that probationary status is not a new hire, but rather the probationary status is as a result of a promotion from a permanent position. Can you address the issue of whether or not under state statute or code or administrative rule there is a property interest in a probationary position as a result of a promotion?
The way you put it just turned out a light for me. No, there is not a property interest. He had no property interest in the promotional position. The property interest must still reside in his original position that he was entitled. He shouldn't have been deprived of that original position after the discipline was overturned. He should have been either restored to a position or a comparable position or put on layoff.
Under the statute, and I'm referring to 230.28(1)(d), that's 230.28(1)(d), as I read that, it states, and you argued this on page 19 of your brief, a promotion or other change in job status, this is your argument on page 19, within an agency shall not affect the permanent status in class and rights previously acquired by an employee within such agency. Is that your argument, and is that pursuant to that statute then?
Yes.
Okay, so
exactly.
I want to make sure I understand it. So you're saying if he's not a probationary, a new hire probation, but a probation as a result of promotion, that he remains a permanent status in class, and that attaches to the permanency he had before the probationary promotion. Is that your position?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just need to verify.
Right.
Isn't there a third question in the framework, and that is what processes do?
No, first question is property right. This
right.
is a subsidiary question. Was he deprived of property? And I believe that in the facts agreed to, he was obviously actually deprived of property when,
mm-hmm.
as a result of the severity of the discipline. Then the court has to decide whether it was clearly established at the time of his discipline that he was entitled to pre-disciplinary due process. My argument from the beginning of the Personnel Commission's decision and the Circuit Court's decision are all based on Cleveland Board of Education versus Loudermill, a 1983 decision, which is supported by a substantial...
Right. What I'm asking decision. Is, Ms. McCauley, what I'm asking is if he is entitled, if there's a pre-disciplinary right to due process, what is that process?
Oh, the Loudermill Court and the following opinions have laid it out fairly clearly. They start with, my mind blanks, Matthews versus Eldridge, 3 points. You have to consider how much process is due. You look to the government interest, you look to the private interest, and you look to what it would entail to give him pre-disciplinary due process. And then the Gilbert Court added, and you look at the, well, I'm sorry, that's part of the employer's interest. Do they have to give
him what do you think
right
he was
away?
What do you think he was entitled to here?
He was entitled, then, according to Loudermill and all these subsequent cases, he was entitled to notice. Notice that he had been charged with something?
Well, he had that. Didn't he have notice? He had a meeting with the personnel people. In fact, they said this is what's happened. Someone has filed a sexual harassment. In fact, he had it was sort of a confrontation or discussion where didn't he indicate that something like, if I'm wrong, you correct me, but this is what I got out of the appendix, that they did have a meeting, so he was aware of that. So that was the notice part. What you're complaining about, I think, is that he did not have a full process, a full hearing.
He did not have notice of the severity of the discipline that would be enacted at the point he was... The Marcia mentioned it in that first meeting, but
yeah,
it was not
she said
clear.
That these, she mentioned the range, didn't she? It could be this, this, or this.
Yes.
Yes.
Then when he was put on leave with pay, he was not informed as to how severe it could be. He was never really told that he was accused of sexual harassment. He learned about it a week later, and he called Marcia and asked her, did this young woman accuse me of sexual harassment? And she said yes.
Okay,
and that's all she said.
So notice
tell
something.
Me what happened. And if you read the disciplinary letter, it's not sexual harassment because he had this conversation with the young woman on the Friday and a following Monday. It's because the young woman accused him of staring at her, bothering her, harassing her, always standing by her. There are like 8 different things that he's accused of. That, in the letter, it sounds like real sexual harassment. As you know, the Personnel Commission said having a conversation about taking pictures when the young woman volunteered her sister as a model is not sexual harassment.
Well, if we're going to get into the facts, but then he said, you know, if your sister isn't interested, do you know any other woman who would be interested in this? I mean, isn't that...
He didn't really pursue it, and if you read the record, it becomes clear.
Which I did. That's why I'm asking.
We don't have the record, unfortunately.
Well, I'm reading from the...
Oh, yeah.
The colloquy, which is in the appendix filed by the state.
This is a matter of... I don't think the question of what he did will be before the jury. But if it were... You could see from, and you can see in the tapes, which have never been transcribed, Mr. Arneson is a tall, rather diffident. He's shy, and he has a very bad stutter. What did I do wrong, or didn't I offer enough pay, was kind of his... awkward way of ending the conversation, and he testified, I was relieved. I knew I didn't want to really take pictures of a young woman.
Let me just bring you back.
So that, in other words, I don't think that he sexually harassed her by asking that.
Let me just bring you back to your saying.
Could she finish answering my question? Because you got to the point that in terms of due process,
okay.
What process she was doing. Oh, go ahead.
I intended to reserve 10 minutes for... I have 5 minutes reserved, I hope.
Yes, for rebuttal, yeah. When your red light goes on, then you will have 5 minutes after that. So you have 5 minutes left right now.
I would prefer to reserve more than 5 minutes. I don't know how much I have left.
Well, you could. I suppose you could stop now and add what's left on this. I just have one question relating to, you're saying the key to this case is the narrow issue of qualified immunity, and then you cite Lauderdale and the cases after that. On the blue brief filed by the state on page 31 and 32, I'll just paraphrase, they indicate that it's a very heavy burden of qualified immunity, which is designed to shield from civil immunity all but the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. Now that's on page 31. This is your opposing counsel. Do you find that in Lauderdale and in Gilbert that, and in reading the statutes 230, you know, the apparent conflict within the statute that a public official in the state of Wisconsin in 1990 clearly would have been put on notice that this is a process that they would have to follow?
Yes, they would.
And why?
From Loudermill, from all of the cases.
Well, what does Loudermill say?
Loudermill says that you can't have deprivation of property, government employee, in other words, property lost in his job, without due process. A minimum due process is required. Minimum due process is, and I didn't finish my enumeration, notice of the charges against him, and specific charges, not just a general, you've been accused of sexual harassment. Notice of what discipline he was facing. Notice of what he's framed as the employer's explanation of the charges. In other words, what it was the young woman was saying about him and why it was so inappropriate. And the right to rebut those charges. He never had the right to rebut any charges. He told them about the conversation he had. Conversation he had was not sexual harassment. For Marcia Jeswinski to say, well, that corroborates what she said, is simply not the case. She said far more than that. In the record, there are, in fact, including her testimony at the hearing, 10 different stories as to what he supposedly did to her. She changed her story every time she talked to somebody, and at least 3 or 4 times in talking to Marcia Jeswinski. But as I say, the facts are not relevant. What's relevant is the denial of due process before he was terminated. And it would have been in the employer's interest to have due process before he was terminated. He could have said, I didn't do all of those things. Then they wouldn't have been deprived of a very valuable employee. He was hard to replace. And he wouldn't have had to wait almost 3 years before he was reinstated in at least a decent position and got his back pay with interest.
Ms. McCauley, I'm sure it's my fault, but I need to come back to what process was due. You indicated that he was not afforded process, due process such as notice, and you enumerated some subcategories, but there clearly is other process that he was due. Was there not? A hearing. I mean,
Yes, post-disciplinary process. He was due a full hearing with the kind of due process you get if you went to trial on a criminal charge.
So he was entitled to a full hearing. And he did not receive it.
And he did receive the full hearing post-disciplinary.
Okay.
But not pre-disciplinary.
But not the pre-disciplinary.
And if he had received the pre-disciplinary hearing, I don't think he would have ever gone to a post-disciplinary hearing.
Mm-hmm.
If he had been allowed to answer those charges.
Okay, any other process, is there any other due process that he was due? Any other process that he was due that he did not receive? So far we've got notice with subcategories, and we've got a right to a pre-disciplinary hearing, which he did not receive. Any others that you claim?
The hearing would involve specific notice of the charges, the employer's explanation, and a chance to counter it. To explain, to say, no, that didn't happen. And in this particular case, I think he probably should have been allowed to call in two of the other subordinates who were infuriated by what the young woman said. And they told me, and I brought them on as witnesses, he didn't sexually harass her. He didn't do anything. He talked to her because she complained at one point that he wasn't paying enough attention to her. So I think that he would have been entitled to call these two witnesses in.
If you'll get yourself organized for your 5 minutes of rebuttal, your time is up now.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Richard Browse Moriarty, Assistant Attorney General of the United States. Please, the Court. We return to the qualified immunity analysis, which is what is brought forward on this case. At every step of that analysis, it's clear qualified immunity should have been granted. It does turn on purely legal questions here. There's an awful lot of references to varying facts, but when you look back at the briefs, we have an agreed and undisputed set of facts that we're working with to the extent that those facts, other facts were mentioned, other witnesses, whatever might have occurred. This analysis, this qualified immunity analysis, should hew to what is undisputed in the record. That's what one of the points made in Arneson 1, for example. Mr. Arneson did not prove that federal law clearly established as of April 1990 that suspending him while on probation as a supervisor and demoting him to the highest available non-supervisory position, which is what undisputedly occurred.
Mr. Moriarty, we have a request that you raise the...
Yes. Mr. Arneson didn't prove that federal law clearly established that as of April 1990, in his probationary position and with the discipline that he received, short of discharge, he was deprived of federal property interests.
Counsel, you qualify your comment by as of 1990 because I think you will concede that federal law now recognizes, under the Gilbert case, that due process clause of the 14th Amendment applies in failing to provide notice and a hearing before a tenured public employee without pay. That is now a recognized right to have notice and a hearing before suspension for a tenured public employee.
Actually, the Gilbert case, even in 1997, stated that it was not going to decide whether that was the case. It was assuming, for the sake of analysis, that was the case. In the Mustafa decision, the Ninth Circuit decision that I submitted earlier, footnote
8, I believe.
Mustafa, 157 Fed Third, that was sent in. They repeated that. They said, like Gilbert, we're simply going to assume, for the sake of argument, that in disciplines short of discharge, there is a property interest. But we're not going to decide that. It is still unclear. It may be that, in fact, at some point, there will be a very clear decision that comes down and says, in disciplines short of discharge, Loudermill applies. That could well happen. It hasn't happened yet.
Your interpretation of Gilbert is that it doesn't apply to cases in less than discharge. I mean, Gilbert's a suspension case, as I recall, a police officer who was suspended and demoted to a groundskeeper.
Right.
And the way that I read it, they were suggesting that Loudermill, and they cited Loudermill, applies even though Loudermill is a discharge case.
In Gilbert, the Gilbert Supreme Court looked back at the Court of Appeals and said, the Court of Appeals assumed that Loudermill applies in the suspension. They held that, and they made their decision that Loudermill was violated, or due process was violated, because of that. The Gilbert Supreme Court said, we're not going to resolve the question of whether it applies short of discharge, but we'll tell you this, the Court of Appeals was wrong in deciding due process was violated in the Gilbert setting by this suspension, by this demotion. So that was the premise they started from. I guess my point is, when you're dealing with qualified immunity, it is not a question of what the law actually is, may turn out to be in the future, may be resolved. It is what was clearly established, what was signaled to supervisors at the time. Counsel tries to reframe that first inquiry, that first step of the inquiry, as you pointed out, Justice Bradley, and erroneously. There are two steps to the analysis. Let's start off. There's two steps to any procedural due process analysis. First, was there a property interest, a federally protected property interest? The second step of a due process inquiry is, if so, if there was a property interest, was it deprived? Was the property interest denied without proper process? When you move into the qualified immunity analysis, therefore, each of those steps requires clearly established law. That's clear from the cases I've cited. There's four decisions that have held that, which are cited in my brief, Brewster, DiQuino, and a couple of others that cite and say the Hannon decision. The first step of that analysis must be, was it clearly established that there was a federal property interest? What if that wasn't the case?
If I may just interrupt, I guess I have, I understand the cases that are cited, particularly the Ninth Circuit case, that follows your argument with regard to clearly established for both prongs. But federal has always bothered me. I mean, generally, as a rule, I think of property interests being granted by state and state law, and you are pushing this federal property, a clearly established federal property interest. Doesn't seem to me that that's what has been tracking in the law, that they are pushing the federal, just clearly established. Do you understand my question?
I understand the question, and it's been confusing for me, and that's why I did try to sit down and put it in terms that I think tracks the law. If it doesn't, then it's certainly my fault. But the property interests derive from state law. That's what the cases hold. It derives from state law. But then when you're looking at whether or not there is a property interest in fact, you look to the federal law. It's the federal constitution. So federal law looks to state law and says, well, wait a minute, what's been created here? Okay, we see some protections. which, in our estimation, looking at federal law, create a property interest under federal constitutional law. And I think that's the distinction, subtle.
I just find that troubling, because I look at the state statute, and I look at the code, and it seems to me there's an argument, and your opposing counsel makes it, that there is a, pursuant to statute, a recognized property interest. Now, that can go both ways. There are arguments on the sides, but I mean, they cite to 230.28, among others, that would suggest that there is state law that recognizes that they have an interest, an employee has an interest in this pursuant to state statute. You know? And again, that tracks with my understanding of property rights are vested through the state. Now, whether or not there is a violation, a constitutional violation, a constitutional taking away of that property is federal, you know, can be federal. But the state property is governed by state law.
I believe the analysis goes, and I don't know that it'll make a difference in the ultimate result in any way, but I agree, we've got to get the analysis straight. And I believe the analysis is, when you're trying to decide, is there a property interest under this federal constitution, the courts, federal and state, both look to state law and say, there it is. There's where that comes from. So they lift it into the federal constitutional analysis and say, okay, now we can say there's a property interest, or we can say there's not a property interest. But I think it's a federal constitutional analysis, and I guess that's why I refer to it as the federal property interest. Hopefully make that clear, and I'm afraid I've made it mud. So let's get back to that first step of the analysis, though. If counsel is correct that all she needed to prove was that there was a property interest. And then, if it's clearly established that process was due, no qualified immunity, then an entry-level probationary employee on a six-month, just hired, you're on probation for 6 months, no question about it, fired after 4 months, discharged, no Loudermill hearing. Appeals to the Personnel Commission. The Personnel Commission, for whatever reason, decides, and can be reasonably looking at the statutes, whatever, decides, you know, this probationary employee did have a property interest. We know it's first impression. We know it's not been said before, but we've looked at it. Here it is. And that becomes the law of the case, whatever it is. Discharge occurred. Therefore, Loudermill clearly applies, clearly established. Is that enough to deny qualified immunity to the supervisor? Certainly not. Because that supervisor at the time was looking at a probationary employee, had no signal that discharging this probationary employee would implicate procedural due process. That was not clearly established, and that's the level.
But that's not the case here.
It's not the case here. And I'm pointing out the importance of that first step of the analysis being clearly established rather than whether there was actually a property interest.
Well, as I understand her argument, she is saying that the demotion to a level that was below MS3 was, in fact, the violation.
Right.
Had he gone back to MS3, I don't think she'd be here today.
Just for the... what we had was he started out in an MIS-4 position, was promoted to an MIS-4 supervisory position when the Personnel Commission action was being implemented, the order was being implemented. He was put back to an MIS-3 at that point because that was the highest available non-supervisory position. I'm sorry, that's what he was demoted to, and then when the Personnel Commission came in, he was moved back up to an MIS-4.
So you have a disagreement of the facts on that, as I understand. You have a disagreement of the facts on that, as I understand. Your opposing counsel says, and in the brief and in argument, says that he was demoted to lower than his initial permanent position.
He was demoted to lower than his initial position. But just for the terminology, he started out at an MIS-4. He was demoted to an MIS-3. And then the Personnel Commission issued his order. He was brought back up to an MIS-4. So there was a demotion. There was a pay loss. In addition to the suspension without pay.
Below his initial permanent position.
Exactly. And so the question comes, and this is interesting. What was he deprived of? Counsel now says he was deprived of that level of discipline. That's where it came in. Due process didn't apply to the probationary position. He had absolutely no rights to that probationary position. Therefore, as I hear the argument, the suspension is meaningless from a due process point of view. Being suspended from the probationary position has no due process implications if counsel's statement is correct.
Well, I don't find it confusing at all, counsel. Maybe I should be confused. But it seems to me that what he is claiming, what Mr. Arneson is claiming here, is that he's not claiming any process rights because of his probationary status at... Now I guess it's MS-5 or whatever. MS-4 supervisor.
Right.
But he is claiming property rights in the MS-4, the position that he held as a permanent employee.
Right.
And he's saying that what you did, not you, but your clients, what they did was put him below that level. And he had a property right in that MS-4 position.
And what did they do? What should they have done? That was the question asked. What should they have done instead? They should have laid him off. That's what counsel said. They should have put him out of employment.
No. We're still on the first prong of the analysis. Are you conceding, therefore, that he did have a property interest in that MS-4 permanent position?
No, I'm not. What I'm saying is this. He had... he had a property interest when he was that MIS-4. Had he been discharged while at that non-supervisory position, this would be an entirely different case.
What if he had been demoted from that MS-4 position? Would he have any property interest?
Without the probation, without the supervisory at all.
Yeah.
In that MIS-4 position, had he been demoted, I think the Gilbert case still leaves that open to debate whether a federal property interest does come into play.
What does the statute say about that? About a demotion from a permanent position?
It says
position?
That you may appeal from a demotion. And it creates a personnel commission appeal as to a demotion. I would wager that if push came to shove, we would find, yes, there is a property interest. But that's not what was clearly conveyed to supervisors at the time, and that's the issue. I think all of us can reasonably agree we would probably see, yes, there's probably a property interest there. But we're lawyers and judges. We're not supervisors.
Yes. Could I ask, if hypothetically, if there is a state property interest, what is the process by which it is established that there's a federal recognition of that state property interest?
I'm sorry, you're asking how does it get clearly established?
You talk about a federally protected property interest, but it derives from state law. What is the process? Like, what do you have to do? I mean, there are 50 states.
Certainly. Yeah. One way was the issuance of the Loudermill decision. That established what happens in cases of discharge as to permanently employed civil service employees and laid out standards for that.
All right. Well, isn't that the point, then, that opposing counsel is making, that we're talking about, all right, if you're conceding or if there was a property interest, then isn't the Loudermill case standing for, all right, then these supervisory people are not entitled to qualified immunity because it was clearly established in 1985 by the Loudermill decision?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. The Loudermill case dealt with a person in a permanent position. They'd obtained civil service status. They had the rights to a hearing before they were discharged from that position. That person was discharged, was not subjected to the discipline less than discharged. They were discharged. Both of those facts are critically different than what we have here. We have a probationary employee, a person in a probationary status, and we have discipline short of discharge. Now, the complication arises from an individual being in a probationary position after having achieved civil service status in another setting. And yeah, what happens then?
I don't see it that way, counsel, and maybe you can tell me where I'm wrong. I don't see this probationary status as really being relevant at all. I think we'd have the same case if he had never gotten this MS-4 or MS-5 supervisory position, but had been demoted from his MS-4 position because of this. Let's assume that he had never gotten a supervisory position but had done exactly the same thing and gotten demoted. Now, the statute says that he can't be demoted except for just cause. So what's the relevancy of this probationary status anyway?
Part of the relevance is, in qualified immunity setting certainly, this court's DHSS decision in 1978, which dealt with a probationary employee that had already been in a civil service status and was discharged from that probationary status, from that probationary position. There was no due process problem there. So if that's the case, what signal was sent to employers as a result of DHSS and the other case law that was present in Wisconsin regarding probationary status?
Well,
it was complicated at the time. And it's certainly not something that any reasonable employer would have been alerted to, would have had a telegraph coming at them. This must be the case.
Let me come at it a different way. I'm Ms. Jaswinski.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at this statute, and I say to myself, okay, what I am doing to Mr. Arneson is to essentially demote him from the position with which he had permanent status. Right?
She could have looked at it that way.
Well, shouldn't she have looked at it that way? Because it's the fact.
Another way to look at it is, I can't leave this fella in a supervisory status in light of what I believe he did.
Right. But
therefore, I've got to find another position for him.
But
I look around and I find the best.
Yes, she finds the best. I don't dispute that at all. But unfortunately, the best was not what the statute required. Then she looks at the statute. She has to have notice of the statute. And it says very clearly that you can't remove somebody with permanent status in class, you can't demote them, except for just cause.
A reasonable employer could have read that statute different ways. Was Mr. Arneson being demoted from his current position to a lower position? Or was he being demoted from his prior position to a lower position?
Okay,
it can be read different ways. And because
I see how you're joking. I disagree.
But what difference? Wasn't he demoted to MS-3?
He was demoted to MIS-3 from and his supervisory probationary position.
You have an MS-4, right? Then you have an MS-4 supervisory.
Right.
Now, it seems to me, I don't care whether he's demoted from the MS-4 supervisory to a 3 or the MS-4 to a 3. Either way, 3 seems like less than 4, which must mean a demotion.
That we can end.
Okay, so he was demoted, right?
Excuse me?
He was demoted, right?
He was demoted. From what?
From either.
But that's the critical point.
Well, let's start. Do you concede that 3 is less than 4?
Yes.
Do you concede that to be demoted from MS-4 to an MS-3 is a demotion?
Certainly.
Do you concede that being demoted from an MS-4 supervisory to an MS-3 is a demotion?
Right.
Do you concede that from either position he sustained a demotion?
That he did, or
he did sustain a
demotion from his supervisory position.
And I understood you to concede that he sustained a demotion also from MS-4. Am I wrong?
This court, looking at these statutes, establishes the principle clearly that when you are taking a probationary employee, you must consider both of the positions and you must look at the demotion effect. Then we're going to have some clearly established law there. But in 1990, we did not, particularly with the DHSS court and the other decisions that we've cited. The question is, do we have the law so clearly established that all but the incompetent or people intending to commit violations of the law are doing so? No. Now, we've talked a lot about the property interest, and I do want to stay talk a little bit about the process itself that was due.
One quick question before you get to that. This is one of the things that bothers me with, if you look at the probationary status, and there's a question of whether or not it's relevant, and Justice Babbage emphasized that in some of his questions, but it seems to me that it's your position that someone who's worked, I'm using a hypothetical, 20 years, hypothetically, 8 kids and a big mortgage, sole breadwinner, and he has permanent status for 20 years, been doing the same thing with the governor, wouldn't he be crazy to take a promotion under your theory? Because then he becomes probationary and can be fired at will for anything. I mean, I would think that any long-serving employee who cares about having some kind of bread on the table would never take a promotion, because all of a sudden his civil service protections of 20 years as being a government employee are thrown to the wind. He has done, under your theory of probationary status.
But I am not saying, and certainly not taking the position, that a probationary employee coming from civil service status has protections. I'm not taking that position at all.
He has a property interest, right?
What I am saying is...
Right, he has a property interest, right?
He has a property interest. I don't understand the connection here, I'm sorry.
Protections from what? I mean...
He has protections from, I guess, arbitrary activity. I want to make the point, I'm not taking the position that the probationary employee has no set of protections. What I am saying is, it was not clear to any supervisor exactly what protections there were, whether there was a property interest, what those implications were, what process was due, and the supervisors facing the situation here certainly did not have clearly established law telling them they were violating the law by what they were doing. Here, what we have is a probationary employee. Now, with the Arneson case in the Personnel Commission, state employees, for example, would not hesitate to take those positions because they've got rights. They've got the ability to appeal to the Personnel Commission on a just cause question, should I have been demoted in this fashion? Does that mean that after getting all this relief that was obtained, the back pay, the attorney's fees, after getting all that, then you can turn around and sue the supervisor individually for having made a mistake based on muddied law? That's the issue. It isn't an issue of whether or not that employee has some rights. They may very well have those rights, and the Personnel Commission decided that Mr. Arneson did and made him whole. Instead, we're asked, are we going to distract these supervisors from their normal duties because they made a decision in April of 1990 where the law was far from clearly established? That's the issue. And what else would they have done? What else would have been done here? We have Mr. Arneson meeting with Ms. Jaswinski, sitting down. She starts to tell him what she knows. She starts to tell him all about the allegations and what happens. And this is all undisputed. It's in the record. He interrupts. and starts telling her what happened. Ms. Jaswinski, it is undisputed, based her decision, regardless of what counsel may say now, it's undisputed, she based her decision on what Mr. Arneson told him and what was undisputed. That's in the affidavits, and it's undisputed. Now, what should have happened? Did he have a due process right to have Ms. Jaswinski say, stop talking, don't tell me anything, I've got to tell you everything first, and then I tell you more? No, he certainly didn't have that due process right. Did he have a due process right to lay all that out and then have Ms. Jaswinski say, okay, now I've got to have you sit down and hear all of our allegations and see if you're going to tell me something contrary to what you've already told me that is more than enough to be disciplined? From my point of view. Now, reasonable minds can differ on what discipline should have been imposed.
What was he?
The personnel commission certainly disagreed, but Ms. Jaswinski believed that was appropriate, and that's what she did.
Well, this is a sexual harassment claim. Was he told that somebody had charged him with sexual harassment?
He asked whether someone had. That was the question she asked, and that's in the affidavits, and she said yes.
At that meeting with Ms. Jaswinski?
Before the meeting. This was the initial conversation. He came up to her and said, has someone accused me of sexual harassment? She confirmed yes. And then a meeting was set up, and at that meeting, she started to tell him the allegations. He cut her off. He cut off the process. And having cut off the process, Ms. Jaswinski listened. She didn't close her ears and took her actions based on what she heard. Now, what should she have done differently? When you look at procedural due process, you don't have a right to a different decision. You have a right to process. What process would have been different? Should there have been a more prolonged, louder mill hearing of some sort? I mean, even if you get past all the qualified immunity issues, there's a serious question of whether there would have been anything done different. I think the record suggests nothing would have been done different. The same discipline would have been imposed. The same result would have occurred. He would have appealed. The personnel commission would have disagreed. They're entitled to do that. They did it. But there would have been no change.
Are you able to complete in one sentence?
I'm sorry.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. McCauley?
I'm not quite sure where to start.
Would you bring that lectern down again, please? Thank you.
No, try another.
Next time, pick an opponent of equal size. that should be.
Can you hear me? Okay.
Sure.
All right. I'm going to try to talk fast because there are so many points to answer. First of all, it is not in the record that Mr. Arneson interrupted Ms. Jaswinski, and it is not in the record that she based her decision on what Mr. Arneson told her.
May I ask a question? And I'm looking at, I referred to this before, I'm looking at the appendix of the defendant, and it has the three affidavits from Jaswinski, Meyer, and Toffley, Page. Appellate page 540 through page 542. And I'm reading this language. 3 days after the meeting, Mr. Arneson sent me an email, among other things, stated that he had never taken pictures like the ones he sought to take of Susan and her younger sister, while stating that parts of him used to, but I always backed out. This made me so sick that I was sure the urge would never come back. This email from your client confirmed my belief that Mr. Arneson engaged in sexual harassment and employment. Then the next number is 11. I consulted with administrators in the classified personnel office, the Office of Affirmative Action and Compliance, and the Office of Administrative Legal Services with others. So, when you're saying this never came, I won't read this in total, but are you saying that this affidavit is, you weren't aware or is incorrect?
Those affidavits were submitted to the circuit court. They are were objected to in circuit court arguments. They are not accurate. They are not supported by the record. He had this 3 days wrong. It was 5 days. Her memory isn't that good. And affidavits have only been countered by argument before the circuit court. This is not testimony that has been cross-examined, and I believe it was wrong.
Excuse me, isn't this what you always have when you have, I think we started out with a motion for summary judgment.
Yes.
And you have, it isn't testimony, it's affidavits. Affidavits from your client, affidavit. That's what I have been and have referred to when I had asked questions of him when you were up before.
Well, those affidavits were disputed, and they have never been subject to cross-examination. She was subject to cross-examination at the Personnel Commission. And, by the way, there's one little item in there. We consulted with other authorities. One of the ways in which the discipline was overturned at the Personnel Commission was to bring in those authorities they consulted, and they were given an erroneous description of what Mr. Arneson did.
Because when I referred, it says at the end of the March 23rd meeting with Mr. Arneson, I informed him that possible disciplinary action would range from reprimand to termination, and that she could consult with appropriate people to discuss the proper level. And then to...
Yes, and then in further discussions with the two supervisors, whose name escaped me now, they did not mention anything so extreme. Let me also point out that it is not only demotion that is being appealed here. There's also a property loss and 30-day suspension without pay, which has been held to be significant in federal cases and by the Personnel Commission. In reviewing this case for oral argument, I discovered that I had more than the 9 cases I cited for his right to due process, more than the